entertain a motion to go out of recess to regular session?
Move.
Motion, Mr. Hudson, second.
Second.
Mrs. Green, questions on the motion? Take the vote, Mr. Schaefer.
Yes.
Mrs. Green.
Yes.
Mr. Hudson.
Yes.
I will be back in regular session. Judge Tolliver.
Let me apologize. I'll move the microphone closer. In addition to being vertically challenged, I'm soft-spoken. It's two strikes. Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Members of Council, Vince Robertson of Parkhouse, Gierke, and Swayze on behalf of the Planning and Zoning Commission. I'm here before you this morning, it's still this morning, on a bit of an unusual situation. Usually, lawyers are defending clients who don't listen to what the law is. Here, I'm defending a client and that's being challenged because it did listen to what the law is. In this case, I want to start with the fact that Coral Lakes was a coastal area subdivision. It was not a cluster subdivision. The superior design standards that apply to coastal or to cluster subdivisions do not apply. As you all may remember, that was changed. We superimposed those on all subdivisions that use the cluster design. So subdivisions like this are by right. Some people may not like that, but that's the law as outlined in the briefing. If the code is follows on a subdivision, it must be approved. That's what East Lake and Ashburn and other cases even cited by Mr. Mehta state. The commission is allowed to impose conditions, which was done here. There are actually 21 of them that were imposed in this case. This law is not disputed by anyone. The Hicks appellants don't like that I explain the law, but they don't dispute my explanation of it. They don't even cite to my explanation of it. So with that, I want to take a moment to talk about the standard of review on one of these appeals. It's governed by Section 99-39 of the Subdivision Code, and what you need to look at is whether the Commission correctly applied and interpreted the code and whether there was an orderly and logical review. We believe that both of those occurred, and therefore the decision of the Planning and Zoning Commission should be affirmed. I'm going to address the Hicks appellants first. They argue three reasons for reversal. One, that the commission did not follow councils, county councils. I mean, there's legal counsel and county council. It gets confusing when we start talking about those two terms. But the Planning and Zoning Commission did not follow county council's instructions. They say that the commission did not conduct an orderly and logical review. And they say that the record fails to demonstrate that the commission's decision was the proper application of the law. With regard to counsel's instructions on remand, counsel specifically directed the commission to consult with its attorney. I want to say that again. The counsel, you all, directed the commission to consult with me as the commission's attorney. There was all sorts of arguments stated that that shouldn't have happened or why did that happen. That's what you told the commission to do on remand. Again, the Hicks appellants never dispute the legal advice provided by me or the law in question regarding subdivisions. In fact, they do cite the same law. And this was not the first time that this legal advice was given. As you may recall, prior to the first vote on Coral Lakes, Commissioner Stevenson asked me to give an explanation on how subdivisions are treated in Delaware. Neither appellant took issue with the specific advice that was given then or now. Instead of disputing the law, the Hicks appellants dispute the ability of me to advise my client, the commission, about what the law is. That is what I was appointed to do, and that's what I was directed to do by you. With regard to the motion itself, I think what's lost in all this on that consideration back in June, that was not the first time that the commission had seen this motion. Recall that a nearly identical motion was made back in March, and the commission considered that, and there were four votes against that motion. There were no reasons given for that motion, and we had a motion to approve and then four votes to deny, and there wasn't any reason given why those four votes to deny should have been made. But the fact of the matter is they had seen the same motion back in March. They had 3 months to consider what that motion said. It was considered again back in June. In that context, I think you also ought to take notice of the fact that all of the Hicks appellants' arguments ignore the motion itself. They never talk about the findings that were in that motion or the conditions that were in that motion. They do state that it was a long one. It was 11 minutes. That's true because it was an extensive motion with a lot of detail in it based upon the record. Instead, they seem to suggest that each member of the commission has to restate or paraphrase the entire motion whenever voting on it. That's not required. Was it read by me? Yes. Is that permitted? Yes, and I'll get into that shortly. But that motion was made by Mr. Mears, and it was seconded by Mrs. Wingate in her during the meeting, and then it was voted on. It was an independent vote. Nobody had to make the motion, nobody had to second it, and everyone could vote how they wanted. In fact, we ended up with a 3-1-1 vote. It wasn't unanimous. If this was a done deal, you'd think it would have been a 5-0 vote, and it wasn't. It was the commission's motion. And we see from what Mr. Mehta put on the screens earlier that the commissioners who voted on it, they referenced the reasons given in the motion as their reasons why they voted for it. And I want to just refer back to that, too. There was questions about, you know, who drafted the motion, et cetera. Recall that it was the same motion made back in March, for the most part. Back in March, that was stated by Ms. Stevenson back on the March 10th, 2022 meeting, that she admitted that we worked very hard on this. It wasn't me. It was the commission worked very hard on it. And then going forward into June, it was their motion. You all cannot ignore or look past the motion itself and its specific findings, as the appellants would suggest. Was there an orderly and logical review? You have to look at this holistically. This wasn't a rehearing, it was a remand. We didn't have a whole nother hearing again at Planning and Zoning. We weren't instructed to do that. It was a remand. So it was based on the record that was made back earlier this year. So when you look back at that hearing, what did the commission discuss? They talked about wetlands. There was discussions about impacts on adjacent development. There was discussions about interconnectivity. There was discussions about stormwater design, the impact of the development on Sarah Run and Love Creek. Questions from the commissions to DelDOT. More discussions about drainage. Discussions about adjacent developments. There was discussions about archaeological studies. There were discussions about adjacent airplane landing strips and the effects of those. Then, the motion made it the first time and again on remand stated that it was based upon the record. Again, there was an orderly logical review because it was based on that record that occurred at that hearing back in early 2022. There was no speculation into why this was approved. There was specific findings related to density, a denial of the bonus density lots for the protection of trees and federal wetlands, addressing DelDOT requirements. The motion addressed the Henlopen TID. The motion addressed the 17 items of Section 99-9C, and there were conditions that related back to that. It addressed central water and sewer. It addressed the coastal area provisions of the comprehensive plan. It required perimeter and wetland buffers and the preservation of trees and other vegetation within that. It addressed that there had to be at least 30% of the site being contiguous open space. It addressed the fact that there was maintenance of streets, roads, buffers, stormwater management facilities, and common areas by an HOA. It talked about sidewalks and street lighting. It talked about amenities. It talked about internal street design and road naming, and it actually required an entire street to be removed and relocated within that subdivision. It talked about the agricultural use protection notice. It talked about the existence of a nearby airfield. It talked about a notice requiring nearby neighbors to be aware that there were hunting activities in the area. And it even talked about what should happen if there were grave sites located in the subdivision. Although the Hicks appellants would ask you to do that, to ignore that, you all can't ignore those findings and those conditions. And I'll just point out, you don't have to take my word for it, there were cites to the record for each of those at pages 13 to 15 of our written submission. The Hicks appellants next acknowledge the rule of East Lake Partners and Tony Ashburn and state about, you know, there can't be a rubber stamp when they say the commission has the further right to scrutinize the layout of the project as depicted on the site plan and attach conditions to it. Again, that's exactly what happened. They're telling us you got to do that? We did it. In addition to the 16 findings, there were 21 conditions of approval doing exactly what East Lake and Ashburn allow. Finally, Council has already determined that an orderly and logical review occurred in its first decision on the subdivision, and it cannot reopen that prior finding. With regard to me reading the motion, there's no issue with that. That is supported by Mason's Manual of Legislative Procedure, which allows others to read a motion. It is consistent with legislative motion practice in the state and here in Sussex County. There are examples provided of that to minutes, and that included Terrapin Island, which was approved by this council on appeal. That goes back, at least with my tenure, to Leighton Johnson and Ronald Lynch when they were on the commission. Those two gentlemen asked me to read motions for them all the time. That practice has continued right through this day for a variety of reasons. It is a non-issue and irrelevant to the substance of this appeal. And it is noteworthy that the Hicks appellants never disputed the legal advice that was incorporated into the motion. In summary, the motion that was made, seconded, and approved was, by its own terms, based upon the record, 16 separate findings and 21 conditions. And the three votes in favor of that motion adopted it as their own. Mr. Metter spent some time reviewing court cases that talk about how a court needs to know exactly and in detail why the subdivision was approved. They cite T.D. Rehoboth versus Sussex County in their written decision and Tate v. Miles, where the court said that the county council in both of those cases had to make a record so that the court could adequately review the decision. Those are distinguishable from what we have here. As you all know, at council, unlike P&Z, a short title is read. Somebody says, so moved, there's nothing more. Then each council person has to give his or her reasons why they're voting on that motion. When the motion's substance is only so moved, the response, I vote yes, doesn't cut it. You need more reasoning so that a court on appeal can decide why you voted yes. Here, there was a very specific motion made with 16 separate findings and 21 detailed conditions. Quoting Tate v. Miles, the commission created a record for its decision through its motion. It's clear to any reviewing court why it was approved. We only need to look at the court chancery case of Gibson v. Sussex County, which was a conditional use for this being okay in the court's eyes. In Gibson, the court quoted the commission's specific reasons given in its motion, like what was done here, and found that this was, quote, articulated reasoning evincing a thorough and rational review. It looked at the motion, not the individual votes. It also commended the commission's caveats imposed in the form of the conditions, many of which mirrored the purposes of the pending conditions in this case. Ultimately, the court's remedy in Gibson was to affirm the commission's reasoning and conditions. Here, Tate versus Miles, T.D. Rehoboth, Gibson, and even Terrapin Island confirm that the commission's motion does provide adequate justification for the commission's decision, and it gives everyone reasons why Coral Lakes was approved. With regard to the question of a written decision, it was issued by the commission staff on June 24, the next day following the vote. That's not in dispute. This was in accordance with the requirements of Title IX that talk about the type of decision that should be issued. And in that case, it talks about a decision being issued in the case of a disapproval. Here, we had an approval, but we still issued a written decision. We also need to look at Planning and Zoning Rule 15.4, which provides further guidance. It says, following a decision by the commission on an application, a copy of the written decision shall be sent to the applicant. That also occurred. There was a written decision issued and sent. The Hicks appellants attempt to attach different requirements to that, but that's not anywhere in our code or Title IX or anywhere else. There's no requirement that it has to be signed by individual members of the commission. That may be a practice some places. I know that it is in some local jurisdictions. That's not a requirement here in Sussex County. It's not in our code, not in our rules. And, you know, there's a question in their briefing about who it was addressed to. It was sent to the applicant as required by Title IX and our rules. So we submit that there was a written decision in compliance with the commission's rules. So in summary, with regard to the Hicks appeal, planning and zoning did follow the council's instructions. Planning and zoning, their decision was an orderly and logical review, and it is not disputed that the record demonstrates that the decision was the proper application of the law. With that, I'd like to turn to Mr. Bartley's arguments. I do want to first address the question of standing. I think it's important for everybody here to understand Mr. Bartley did not even appear at the hearing. He did not submit anything into the record during the hearing. He stood by and did nothing when he could have participated. There's a question of how you can claim to be aggrieved when you didn't step up at the hearing in the first place. That would have been the time period to raise your concerns about a subdivision, make them known to the Planning and Zoning Commission, and then fall back on them in appeal. Here, he didn't do that. He does not live in close proximity to the subdivision. He does not allege in any way, shape, or form how he's an aggrieved party. Again, what's his injury? He didn't even show up to the hearing in the first place. That's a minimum threshold requirement of 99-39, and Mr. Bartley has not satisfied it. So with that, I would submit, as we did in our written submissions, that his appeal should not be considered by council. Reserving that, I'm going to go forward and address his items that he raised in his appeal and his written submission. The first one is the notice requirement. I'm going to stand by the statement that we made in our written submission that this was an argument that was not raised below. Mr. Bartley wasn't there, and nobody else raised it during the public hearing, so it cannot be raised now on appeal. And that's in accordance with Judge Tolliver's September 16th, 2022 ruling, where he said, even if timely raised, an argument or evidence not part of the record below cannot be considered on appeal. Mr. Bartley tries to bootstrap that by referring back to a statement made by Ms. Hicks about plush review. That had nothing to do with the legal notices that were published, mailed to people, and posted on the property. It had to do with plush review, and actually it sort of is counter-indicative of his argument, because he points out that she had access to all the documents that he claims he couldn't find because of the notice problems. So it doesn't really help his claim. But it's clear that the notice worked. There were 11 people who spoke in a large crowd, and there were numerous letters submitted. And of all those people who were in attendance, there were no complaints about notice raised during the hearing. He does cite the Title IX requirements for hearing notice, but they don't support his claim either. Was the purpose stated? Yes. Were the dates stated? Yes. Was the time stated? Yes. Was the place stated? Yes, County Council Chambers. Did it describe the area to be subdivided? Yes. Did it show where the right to inspect was? Yes. Mr. Bartley seems to make some emphasis that it has to be a physical place, and it did list a physical place. The location of the hearing was provided. It is the Planning and Zoning hearing. The documents are in possession of the Planning and Zoning Department. It also provided a website, which is something that we have strived to do for the citizens of Sussex County by making documents more accessible. So the sussexcountyde.gov address was provided, where those are uploaded and available to anybody who wishes to see them. He does claim that the website is not a place, but it is a place where you go to locate the documents if you do not travel to Georgetown. And then finally, sort of as a catch-all, the address, or excuse me, the phone number of the Planning and Zoning Commission is provided to anybody. They can't figure any of that out. They can call the commission and figure out, how can I see those documents? There's no issue with notice, and regardless, it was not raised below. Mr. Bartley talks about the commission's alleged failure to hold a fair and orderly public hearing. I'm not going to reiterate everything I said before with regard to the Hicks appellants, but that all applies equally here. The hearing itself, I don't think anybody disputes that it was fair and orderly, and again, you all confirmed that the first time around on remand. Mr. Bartley is focusing on my statement about the law and Mr. Whitehouse's statement about the information in the record, that it was compliant with the zoning and subdivision codes. With regard to my statement, again, that was fully compliant with your directive to consult with legal counsel. Again, that's exactly what happened. In Mr. Whitehouse's statement, he did not add any new evidence to the record. He simply confirmed what was in the record and that it complied with the zoning and subdivision codes. This was compliant with counsel's directive to consider the record, all evidence and facts of the application. It is appropriate for the commission staff to advise the commission. Mr. Whitehouse is such a member of the commission and staff that he's authorized to sign plots on behalf of the commission each year. He's not just some member of the public or some third party. He's commission staff, integral to the hearing and subdivision process. In fact, if staff participation was considered testimony or evidence, no record would ever be closed. And if we flip it around, think about it this way. The commission could never be prevented from consulting with staff during its discussions. That's what they need to be able to do, to ask questions of staff and get information from staff. Regardless, it was merely a confirmation based on what was in the record. With regard to site plan compliance, again, I'm going to suggest that this was not raised during the hearing below, and it should not be considered again for the first time on appeal. Having said that, there are two issues that Mr. Bartley raises. One has to do with easements, and the other has to do with the grading plan. With regard to easements, he claims that there were none shown. There's a simple reason for that. None exists at the time you come in for a preliminary site plan approval. I mean, if you think about this, like, think about our county engineering department. They're not going to engineer a sewer plan for pipes and pump stations before something receives preliminary site plan approval. They do that after the fact. Same thing with the Delaware Electric Co-op, Delmarva Power, Tidewater, Artesian, whoever's providing water, internet, whatever. You get preliminary site plan approval, you establish where those easements go, then you should put that on the final site plan. That's just a non-issue. It was accurate, that site plan was accurate as to whatever record easement existed at the time. The second one is the grading plan. The same analysis holds true with regard to that. There were grades of the property shown on the plan, but more importantly, it was not ignored. The grading plan was a requirement for the final site plan as condition S of the commission's motion. With that regard, the commission does have the ability to modify or waive its requirements under section 99-35 of the subdivision code. That happens frequently. For example, if we get a four-lot subdivision, we're not going to require them to have a grading plan at all because that's cumbersome and really too much work for somebody that wants to subdivide off a couple or three lots. In this case, we required them to do it, but the commission required them to do it at the time of final site plan, just like when they would show all those easements and everything else. So again, the commission was in its rights to specifically require this element to be shown at the final site plan stage. Mr. Barley expends quite a bit of time talking about wetlands. He says wetlands means all wetlands. The problem is Mr. Barley doesn't tell us what he means by what a wetland is. There are two types of wetlands. There's regulated versus unregulated. Unregulated just being areas that happen to be wet. We define wetlands in the code as federal or state. Federal regulated by the Corps of Engineers, state regulated by DENREC. Mr. Barley expects the county to regulate other soil types or damp ground areas, but never provides any authority for that, again, because there is none. Regardless, he cites the section 115-25E that all lots must be configured to be outside of all wetlands. 115-25E doesn't apply to this subdivision. This was, recall, a coastal area subdivision. 115-25E is within the requirements for an AR1 cluster subdivision. There are two different standards. The wetlands section that he cited does not apply to this type of subdivision. And that was actually confirmed in finding number 4 of the commission's decision, which neither appellant challenges. So again, Mr. Bartley's reliance on 115-25EV is misplaced. In the site plan, there are 5.65 acres of non-tidal wetlands that are regulated by the Corps. By the commission's decision, those won't be disturbed. They are buffered, and they actually got conditions imposed to protect them. There was denial of that bonus density so that lots would be pulled away from them. As I mentioned, there was a road that was relocated to be pulled away from those wetlands. Mr. Bartley claims that there were 18.36 other acres of land that happens to be wet at times that should not be touched. Again, there's no regulation to support this. And I was thinking about this, having lived through the buffer ordinance and some other things that we talked about having to do with wetlands, I can't imagine the commission or you all telling farmers that lands that are unregulated and may be damp are suddenly unbuildable. They have to be based on the code requirements. Again, the regulated wetlands were protected adequately through the conditions of the approval. And finally, the density calculation that was raised by Mr. Barley. I'll admit it took me about 5 times to read that to understand what he was stating in that. And I think basically, I came to the conclusion that what he is asking the commission to do and you all to affirm is that you determine density based on a site plan, not based on the zoning code. Density is based on what the zoning code says. He also plays around with the reference to what a lot is. At the time of subdivision, the lot is the entire parcel. If you've got 100 acres, it's a 100-acre lot. That's what you determine density off of. So if you have 100 acres, you get 2 units an acre, you got 200 lots. That's how you do it. What he would do, or say you have to do, is you take that 100 acres, you design a subdivision on it, and you figure out where the lots are, where the roads are, where the common open space is, knowing that you would never actually build that subdivision. You would design that subdivision so that you can figure out what your density is. I'll say, okay, I've got 100 acres. I can put 200 lots on there. I know that there's 200 lots and the open space covers 160 acres. Then, under his logic, you got to take that 160 acres, multiply that times 2 and figure out, 160 lots. Let me back up, I messed that up. If you have a 100-acre subdivision, you can get 200 lots on that subdivision. You design it with those 200 lots, with the road and with the open space. Then you determine the acreage covered by those 200 lots and common open space. That gives you 60 or 80 acres covered by those things. And then that determines your density. So once you have that first subdivision design, you figure out what's covered by lots and open space. That gives you your density. And then you have to design a whole new subdivision based on that acreage and density calculation. That's not how it works. That would be a waste of everybody's time and resources. And plus, it'd be never-ending, because then you'd have another site plan with lots on it and open space that would give you acreage that you'd have to then calculate density and then design another subdivision based on it. It's just, it's never-ending. And there's a simple answer to that. It's not based on site plan design. It's based on what the code says. And that's the 2 units an acre that's out there in our zoning code. So I think that's covered most all of it. I think in closing, I just want to summarize. Nobody's disputed that planning and zoning misapplied or misinterpreted the county code. Nobody even disputes the law that I read to the Planning and Zoning Commission and my explanation to them. They don't like that I told them what the law is, but they don't say what I said was wrong. So let's start with that. And the fact of the matter is, you all directed me to give that advice, and it was the second time that I had done it. The Planning and Zoning Commission's findings were the result of an orderly and logical review. Let's think about what that includes. That was the initial hearing back in January that lasted forever, where we heard a lot of information from the applicant, people with an interest, people opposed to this application. Then we had another vote based on a motion that was substantially similar to the one that they considered earlier this summer. All of that was the result of an orderly and logical review. And we can look at the product that was that motion, where there were 16 findings and 21 conditions of approval. It wasn't as though somebody just said, yes, I like this subdivision, I vote in favor of it. There were 16 findings and 21 conditions of approval. It was not a rubber stamp, and nobody should be suggesting that it was. And then finally, council's instructions on remand were followed. For all those reasons, I would submit that the commission's decision should be affirmed this morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor, and members of council. My name is John Horner. I'm the general counsel for Shell Brothers LLC, the applicant for the Coral Lakes project. The procedural posture of this appeal has already been outlined by others, so I won't spend additional time repeating it. I'd like to start out by saying Coral Lakes is a by rights application, meaning the property is zoned AR1 and the proposed use of the project is residential single-family housing consistent with the AR1 zoning. The appellants today consist of some immediate neighbors of the project, as well as an individual who lives miles away from the project. Today we are here because those appellants are asking you to disregard the law, the Constitution, property rights, and the sound, orderly, and logical review of the Planning Commission because they do not want this project near them. Why don't they want it? Well, for the Hicks appellants, that's a simple question with a simple answer. They live next door to the project and they've enjoyed wooded views from their homes as well as the unrestricted use of that forest. Upon hearing of this application, they immediately began opposing it under the premise of preserving the forest, despite the fact that the same forest they are allegedly trying to protect is the exact same forest which was cut down for them to build their homes and the road servicing their homes. I understand where the Hicks appellants are coming from. I think if given the option, we would all prefer to have a forest in our backyard that we didn't have to pay for rather than homes. Or given the option, we want to be able to tell our neighbors exactly what to do with their land or to tell our neighbors that we want their land to remain untouched. Luckily for the applicant, the rule of law still prevails in this country, and a neighboring property owner's desire to control the use of someone else's land is trumped by the property rights of the owner of that land. The same property rights that allowed each of the appellants to build their homes are the same property rights that demand the affirmation of the approval of this application. With that being said, Ms. Maurer will be addressing the appeal filed by the Hicks appellants, which I can honestly say is the first time I've heard a lawyer argue that you should not follow the advice of your lawyer, and I will be addressing the appeal filed by Mr. Terrence Bartley. I'd like to first start with a brief recitation of the standard review, even though you've heard it a little bit before. Some of what you're going to hear, Mr. Robertson stole my thunder, but I'll try to keep it concise. The Planning and Zoning Commission, I apologize. The Council may only reverse the decision of the Planning and Zoning Commission upon a finding that the Commission made an error in its interpretation of the applicable sections of the Subdivision Code, or that the Commission's findings and conclusions were not the result of an orderly and logical review of the evidence and the applicable provisions of the Subdivision Code. If there is substantial evidence that demonstrates the Commission's decision was based on an orderly and logical review of the evidence and the law was accurately applied, the Council must uphold the Commission's decision. The burden of proof is on the appellant, here the Hicks and Mr. Bartley, to show the Commission erred and there was no orderly and logical review of the evidence. As this council stated in the Terrapin Island appeal, the council's review is limited to correcting errors of law and determining whether substantial evidence exists to support the commission's findings of fact, and that when substantial evidence exists, the council will not reweigh it or substitute its own judgment for that of the commission. Simply stated, this council is not reviewing this matter de novo or anew. The review is limited to reviewing the process and the findings of the commission. Prior to addressing Mr. Bartley's substantive arguments, I'd like to first address the threshold issue of standing. Mr. Bartley lacks standing to pursue this appeal under Delaware law and legal precedent, as well as under the Sussex County Code. Because he lacks standing, his appeal must be dismissed. Delaware courts have stated clearly that for an individual to have standing in a matter like this, they must demonstrate the interest they seek to protect or within the zone of interest the ordinance seeks to protect and allege a related injury in fact. With regards to the injury in fact, the courts have further said that the appellant has to have suffered an injury that is concrete and particularized, the injury is fairly traceable to the challenge action, and the injury can be remedied by a favorable decision. Similarly, Sussex County Code confers standing only to an appellant that has been aggrieved by the decision of the commission. It does not use broader language such as a citizen of Sussex County, a taxpayer of Sussex County. It specifically says an appellant must be aggrieved by the decision of the commission. Let's analyze those two standards briefly. Looking first at the Delaware case law standard, Mr. Bartley does not allege or even attempt to allege any particular harm that is concrete and particularized. This is because he does not live by the Coral Lakes Project. He lives miles away based on his address and his appeal filings, and there is no particularized harm that would befoul him with the approval of this project. As such, he's not met this burden of showing an injury in effect, and the appeal must be dismissed under Delaware law. Looking next at Sussex County Code, Mr. Bartley cannot say he has been aggrieved by the decision of the commission. A review of the record shows Mr. Bartley did not participate in the public hearing stage at all. He did not testify, he did not write letters, he did not sign petitions, he did nothing. How can someone who declined to participate in the process claim to be aggrieved by it? If this council allows appeals of this nature to proceed, it opens the door for nonstop nuisance appeals of by right subdivisions. What's next? A person from Delmar appealing a subdivision near Milford? The Citizens versus Smyrna Clayton first case cited in our filings is this positive here. In that case, the court answered the question of whether an adjoining landowner, which Mr. Bartley is not, had standing to challenge an approval as being contrary to law. The court held no in that matter because the plaintiff could not establish an interest that was distinguishable from other residents of the town, and here in this case the county, and because Mr. Bartley cannot establish any injury that is different from other residents of the county, he lacks standing. When confronted with the issue of standing in his reply briefs, Mr. Bartley cited to 9 Del C 6811 to state that it confers standing upon him. However, 9 Del C 6811 just broadly states any approval or disapproval may be appealed to the county government within 30 days of the official action of the county government. Mr. Bartley seemed to add in Sussex County residents are granted standing by this. That is not the case. There are several statutes throughout the law that confer, that grant appeal rights, specifically the Court of Common Pleas, you can appeal to the Superior Court. That does not mean that any party can appeal to the Superior Court. It only means parties with standing can appeal. If this language had specifically included, as was the case in a recent decision by Judge Karsnitz, language that said a taxpayer or a resident had an appeal right, then standing would be conferred as a matter of statutory interpretation. Here, it does not. Mr. Bartley's interpretation would confer standing on anybody, anywhere, solely because an appeal right exists, and that simply is not the law. He next argues standing based on vague constitutional protections and due process related to those notice requirements. In fact, courts have consistently held the opposite. There's numerous cases cited throughout our briefs that essentially and specifically say that you do not have a constitutionally protected right in the by rights land use of another landowner. It is that landowner that has the constitutionally protected right, not you. Said more clearly, a member of the public does not have protectable constitutional right and property owner's right to use the property. The cases cited by Mr. Bartley dealing with this dealt specifically with rezonings or conditional uses, not by rights subdivisions. Again, based on Delaware law and a clear reading of Sussex County Code, Mr. Bartley's appeal must be dismissed due to lack of standing. Mr. Bartley alleges the public notice for the public hearing was deficient because it did not state the place at which the text and maps related to the proposed change may be examined. Mr. Robertson covered this in great detail, but in short, the place and where the maps could be located and studied was provided, a website was provided, an address was provided, a phone number was provided, and all of these meet and comply with the code. Mr. Bartley seems to argue that a website is not a place and therefore it needs to be a physical place for inspection of these documents and that these documents cannot exist in multiple places. That seems illogical to me. We can copy things, we can scan things, we can reproduce things, and generally you would want these documents to be available in as many places as possible to allow for the most public involvement. And notably, as Mr. Robertson pointed out, there is no allegation that the appellants were unable to find these documents. In fact, quite to the contrary, these documents were specifically referenced in public comment during the public hearing process. Although it's interesting that, and you'll hear this a lot throughout discussing this, but this notice issue was never raised by Mr. Bartley or anyone during the public hearing process. And again, this same county council in the Terrapin Island appeal stated clearly that an issue that was not raised before the Planning and Zoning Commission could not be subsequently raised on appeal when it stated, and I quote, "Council is not permitted to consider any issues and arguments raised by appellant on appeal that were not raised below as they are considered waived on appeal. To allow an appellant to do so would create due process violations and incentivize plan opponents to sit back and raise the issue only on appeal, prejudicing the applicant and wasting governmental time and resources to handle frivolous appeals." In his reply brief, Mr. Bartley cites a case from a Florida state court interpreting Florida law for the premise that new issues can be raised for the first time on appeal under the fundamental error doctrine. This doctrine in Delaware has only been loosely applied in the context of criminal law cases for what we could find, and each of those required a deprivation of a constitutional right in order for there to be fundamental fairness implicated. Here, as stated before, there is no constitutional right implicated for an adjacent landowner or another member of the public related to a by rights use of land by a landowner. And again, Mr. Bartley did not participate in the public hearing process at all. Despite ample opportunity to raise this issue, he did not. However, even if he had, the notice was complied with and the provisions of the law were complied with. Mr. Bartley next argues that an orderly public hearing was not held, and he bases that assertion on a comment made by staff outside of the public hearing during the deliberations on the application triggered by this council's remand. Mr. Bartley argues that the colloquial use of the phrase "for the record" when Mr. Robertson asked Director Whitehouse to confirm the application complies with the subdivision and zoning code somehow turned the deliberations into a new public hearing. That's not how this works. The commission is allowed to consult with its staff, including its attorney and planning and zoning staff, and these deliberations and discussions are customary and ordinary, and in fact encouraged. Furthermore, Mr. Whitehouse's statement was not new. It was a confirmation of facts already in the record and confirmed by the motion of the commissioners previously made. Mr. Bartley's approach would render it impossible for planning and zoning staff and its attorney to do their job and for the commission to consult their expertise during deliberations. It would create a veritable minefield wherein any remark by a staff member or the commission's attorney would trigger new notice and hearing requirements. This is not how the process works, and Mr. Whitehouse's confirmation that the application meets the code did not create a new public hearing and thus render the public hearing not orderly. And to that point, as Mr. Robertson indicated, this council has already found in the prior appeal that the process was orderly. Specifically, and I quote, this council found that the commission engaged in an orderly process such that the applicant filed the application, the commission received and reviewed the comments and reports from various state agencies, the public, etc. A public hearing was held and the commission discussed the issues before it. As such, there's no possible logical rationale for overturning that decision as the law of case doctrine, as we've outlined in our brief, supplies. But speaking plainly, I don't know how you turn an already orderly review into an unorderly one. Now, even if you agree with Mr. Bartley that Mr. Whitehouse's statement somehow constituted testimony in a new public hearing, the remedy would be to disregard his statement. And even if that were done, substantial evidence still exists to uphold the decision of the commission. Mr. Bartley most likely did not like the confirmation by Director Whitehouse because he bases some of his argument on appeal, arguing that the plan does not comply. Specifically, Mr. Bartley wrongfully states that Section 99.8b requires the planning and zoning staff to confirm the plan's compliance with the code. That does not comport with the plain reading of that statute. Specifically, that statute requires the plan to be checked by the staff to determine its conformity with the law. That review occurred, and it's undisputed that it occurred. The staff provided a response letter, and then the applicant responded to those comments. The planning and zoning staff, specifically Director Whitehouse, then confirmed that the plan met code. Mr. Bartley seeks to avoid this fact in his latest filing by raising new issues for the first time, which again is not permitted. The bottom line here is that the plan complies with the code as confirmed by Director Whitehouse and the extensive record. The review by staff required under 99.8b occurred, and the staff again confirmed that it complies. Mr. Bartley cannot overcome these facts. Mr. Bartley next wrongly asserts that the application does not comply with the code because the application has lots configured within the wetlands areas. As Mr. Robertson indicated, this is a coastal area subdivision and not a cluster subdivision. The provision cited by Mr. Bartley related to lots being located in wetland areas is not applicable to this project. But again, even if it were, Mr. Bartley is simply wrong here. First, it is important to note that despite Mr. Bartley's contentions, wetlands under state, county, and federal law does not in fact mean all wetlands. There are regulated wetlands on the property, but those are located at the rear of the property and will not be disturbed. In fact, those jurisdictional wetlands have buffers around them in excess of what is required by code, and in fact is in compliance with or in excess of the wetlands buffer ordinance that was passed subsequent to this project and not applicable to this project. The areas where the lots are located do not contain any wetlands that are regulated by federal, state, or county law. Those areas, which are better described as low wet areas than wetlands, fall outside the scope of regulation for the county, which refers to the federal and state definitions promulgated by the federal government and DENREC. Testimony reports provided by the applicant and its expert in the record, including a jurisdictional determination from the Army Corps of Engineers, indicated clearly that these low wet areas where lots will be constructed are not wetlands subject to any governmental jurisdiction and do not meet the definitions of wetlands promulgated by DENREC or the federal government. This same interpretation of what constitutes wetlands subject to the jurisdiction of the county has been utilized by the Commission in multiple project approvals, including the recent approval of the Eastgate subdivision, which contained lots in isolated wetlands not subject to any governmental jurisdiction. As noted in our submissions, the Commission's interpretation of the code should be given deference, and furthermore, the applicant relied on that interpretation when submitting the application. Accordingly, as set forth in our submissions, the doctrine of equitable estoppel prevents this council from arbitrarily changing that interpretation in the middle of the application process. Furthermore, to the extent any ambiguity exists in the law, and we feel the law is clear here on the definition of wetlands and what is and is not regulated, any ambiguity would be construed in the favor of the landowner, as the landowner is the party with the protectable property interest. In short, Mr. Bartley is again plainly wrong with his argument here. He wrongly asserts this code provision applies to the project when it does not, and he wrongly states that the wetlands where lots are located are jurisdictional wetlands subject to the regulation of the county. One last point I would like to make is that recently the county did pass the wetlands buffer ordinance, and in that process they reviewed resources that were in need of protection. That ordinance specifically again reaffirmed the intent not to regulate these low isolated wetlands, as it does not contain any buffers or regulation of these low isolated wet areas. The last of Mr. Bartley's arguments relates to the density calculation for the proposed subdivision. As stated previously, this issue was never raised below, and based on relevant case law in this council's Terrapin Island decision, the council may not consider this issue on appeal. However, even if the council were to consider this issue on appeal, Mr. Bartley is again wrong. First, it is important to note that density is a function of zoning and is calculated for a property based on the zoning for the property. As such, the density for the Coral Lakes property is established and calculated prior to the submission of plan and does not change with the submission of a plan. At the time density is calculated for Coral Lakes project, the project was two tax parcels or two lots. The definition of gross area, as defined in the code, resides in the zoning code and not the subdivision code, and specifically includes the lot areas and the area of land set aside for common open space or recreational use, but shall exclude any area designated as a tidal, tributary, stream, or tidal wetlands. Again, density is determined in the zoning code, not the subdivision code. Here, at the time density is calculated, the entirety of the Coral Lakes project consisted of a gross area, as defined by the code, of 152.34 acres, which allows for 304 lots, exactly what was approved here. Mr. Bartley attempts to shoehorn in a definition of open space into the definition of common open space, which is not defined in the code. However, that definition of open space or common open space is irrelevant when one reads the definition of gross area. Gross area includes lot areas and the area of land set aside for common open space or recreational use. At the time of the application and the determination of density, the entire project was within lots. You do not even need to get to the next step of analyzing common space or open space because you've already satisfied lot areas. The Commission and this Council have a long-standing historic practice of calculating density in the exact same manner as it was calculated for Coral Lakes. As outlined in the submissions, deviating from that interpretation would create due process violations, throw every prior AR1 approval into question, of which, as you all are aware, there are many. and create equitable estoppel issues. Lastly, I'd like to direct everyone's attention to Mr. Robertson's brief on this point, and he also articulated it. But if you were to apply Mr. Bartley's interpretation to the code, it would create essentially an endless loop of redesigns wherein you design a project, then you have to measure the area of the roads and other impermeable surface. That's going to then reduce the amount of lots you have. You then would have to reduce your lots, redesign the project, recalculate the area of impermeable surface, and do it again and again and again until you essentially end up with one lot. Which is clearly not the intent of a subdivision code. In closing, it's clear that the Planning and Zoning Commission conducted an orderly and logical review of the record and properly applied the law when approving Coral Lakes. As such, this council should affirm the decision of the Planning and Zoning Commission. I now defer to Ms. Mowry, who will be addressing the appeal filed by the Hicks appellants.
This is not a lot that hasn't been said yet, but I will try to just briefly cover a few points on the Hicks appeal. I'm Kate Mowry of Richards, Layton & Finger, representing Shell Brothers. Good morning, Judge Tolliver, council members. Thank you for your time this morning. I think it's truly remarkable, the argument being made here today by the Hicks appellants, that somehow the commission did something wrong by following the advice of their legal counsel. Yes, I think that is the crux of their argument, that it was illogical and disorderly and an improper application of law to have legal counsel advise on Delaware law and then to follow Delaware law. And as you've heard, it's not what advice was provided. It's not the Delaware law was incorrect in the way that it was provided. It was correct, and it was the Delaware law. And the Hicks don't object to the way that it was presented or the actual substance therein. It is just the fact the commission shouldn't have followed legal, basically, the advice on Delaware law. Or that somehow legal counsel, that he made the decision for the commission by reading that Delaware law into the record and reading Commissioner Muir's motion into the record. That's not correct. What legal counsel did here is compliant with law and absolutely appropriate. And in fact, the job of legal counsel, what he did, again, this counsel told him to consult with a commission, and that's what he did. Not sure what else legal counsel would do if not advise on Delaware law. This appeal and that attenuated argument can be dismissed quite easily. In addition to the reason that it is an attenuated argument, the procedure taken during the June 23rd commission hearing, including legal counsel's advice on Delaware law and the commissioners following that law, complied with this counsel's instructions on remand. It complied with this Delaware and Sussex County Code, the Commission's procedures, Delaware law, and prior precedent of this council. And on that last issue, you did not hear the Hicks appellants here today talk much about prior precedent. I will mention, as you all probably recall, last year the same council affirmed Terrapin Island's preliminary plat approval. And that decision was based on a procedure almost identical to this one here. The only difference is that here in Coral Lake's application, actually additional evidence of careful consideration was provided than in Terrapin Island. So Shell submits that it cannot be that this council would find that process logical and orderly and the proper application of law and not this one. I do want to talk about the record. But before I do that, I'll note that for the same reasons as outlined by Mr. Horner and in the arguments in our briefing, the Hicks appellants do not have standing to bring their claim. It is their burden. They've not met it with their generalized concerns. Getting to the record, the appellants argue that Shell is fleeing from the record. I think you heard them running from the record even today. It is actually the opposite. Shell accepts the record as it stands. Which shows an orderly and logical review and proper application of the law. And we set that forth in our papers. We were not hiding from anything. The Hicks, however, seem to be the ones fleeing from the record, right? They want to ignore a large portion of it, in fact. They want to ignore the 12 pages of transcript motion made by Commissioner Mears. And it is improper on this appeal to ignore any part of the record below. It is counsel's... They need to review the entire record, which would include the motion itself. The Hicks would have the motion completely written out of the record, which is just not the case. I don't know if I know how to do this, actually. Oh, down here. And you all have this in your on your desk, but I just did want to point to the motion itself, as it hasn't really been raised much by the Hicks appellants. Here's the motion. I pulled it from the June 23rd meeting minutes, and at a quick glance, it's clear to see that this in itself would have been sufficient to show an orderly and logical review of the evidence. It's extensive and detailed. It spanned, as the Hicks appellants have said, 11 pages. I counted 12. The motion, I can't even fit it on one screen here. The motion contains a recitation of Delaware law, 16 findings, 21 conditions, specific reference to the code requirements and that the application met those requirements, a statement that the motion is based on the hearing record below, reference to specific testimony and evidence of that hearing, and conditions that specifically address unique aspects of the evidence that were presented at the hearing. That was all presented in our hearing as that was all in our briefing as well. In Terrapin, I want to note, the council found a motion just like this one, very similar in format, showed careful consideration of the record. And there's no reason that the same is not true here. Additionally, if that wasn't enough, the commission did more than just this motion. And a voice vote, which is what happened in Terrapin. They read the motion, they did a voice vote, and that was sufficient. Here, there was also the fact that each commissioner stated reasons for his or her vote. And that's actually more than what was done in Terrapin. And that's what this council asked the commission to do on remand. And I'll briefly go through each one of those votes, just so that you can see that they show logically an orderly review and proper application of the law and are not, in fact, post hoc rationalizations by counsel. You can read the actual reasons yourself as I click through them. Commissioner Wingate, I'm a yes for the extensive explanation by counsel and the conditions imposed. I'll remind you the extensive explanation by counsel was an explanation of Delaware law and then the reading of Commissioner Muir's motion. So I'm not sure what else the Hicks appellants would require here that Commissioner Wingate say. Commissioner Wingate is agreeing with Delaware law and the motion, as well as the conditions. Commissioner Mears, Mr. Chairman, I voted against this application because of the trees, the wetlands, the flooding, etc. Unfortunately, as counsel explained, it complies with the subdivision and zoning code. Therefore, I vote yes based on the reasons in the motion. Again, legal counsel explained Delaware law and read Commissioner Mears' motion into the record. Commissioner Mears is agreeing here that the application complies with the subdivision and zoning codes, as stated by, you know, as stated by the law. The law was stated by legal counsel. He adopts the motion and then votes in favor of it. I'm not sure what's wrong here or what more could possibly be required. Commissioner Wheatley says, and the chair votes yes for the reasons stated in the motion and for the simple fact that we simply have to honor the rule of law as it's written. I don't think it gets more clear than that. Each of these votes shows individual consideration and independent articulation, an agreement with the motion and the conditions. Further, there is no evidence, and you can look at the record upside down, sideways, and there's nothing in that record that legal counsel directed the commissioners on how to vote. He stated the law of Delaware, and he read Commissioner Mears' motion into the record. There were also two commissioners who did not vote in favor of the application approval, which shows that there was individual thought by each and articulation and consideration by each commissioner, and that legal counsel did not direct the vote. And I'm putting up Commissioner Stevenson's here. She says, I'm not voting because I was told what our council said was that we can't deny it. And the reasons I am is that I'm not opposed to this property being developed, even at the proposed density. I have serious concerns with the site plan. Again, as I said, this shows individual thought and articulation. To the extent the appellants argue, our council said that we can't deny it, shows legal counsel told them how to vote, that's incorrect. Because first of all, you have the full record of the June 23rd hearing. Read it. There is nothing in that where Mr. Robertson tells the commission how to vote. What this means, what Ms. Stevenson is saying here, she's tacitly understanding that because Coral Lakes meets all of the subdivision and zoning codes, it can't be denied under Delaware law, as articulated by legal counsel. And as a result, because she refuses to vote in favor, despite Delaware law, she abstains. And then finally, there's Commissioner Hopkins, who voted no because of issues with wetlands. Again, this shows individual consideration and no direction by council. As I said a couple times, the appellants complained about the procedure, but it's unclear under their position what would have been sufficient. And nonetheless, what the commission did here complies with Delaware statute as well as Delaware case law. Under 9 Delaware Code 6811, that only requires grounds for decision when a plat is disapproved, not when it's approved. And that makes sense. If the plat complies with the code, it complies. There's no reason to then restate each way in which it complies, right? A vote in favor of the motion is a vote stating that the land, the plat application complies with the code. If it doesn't comply, then it makes more sense to have to explain why it doesn't, and because it could be taking away property rights from a landowner. With respect to Delaware case law, the cases cited by the appellants actually clearly provide that the procedure here provides this council with sufficient clarity. Vice Chancellor, former Vice Chancellor Slice and T.D. Rehoboth states there, he's referring to council because that was on a rezoning application, but he says council does not have to follow any particular roadmap when reciting the grounds for its decision. Perfection is neither expected nor required. Instead, it is enough that council states its reasons with sufficient clarity that the court is not left to guess why the decision was made. As I just went through each one, there is no room for guessing. Each one explained that they approved, the three that approved the plan explained why they did so. Finally, in addition, the commission followed remand instructions. I think that's been covered. It was in our papers. And by Mr. Robertson, they've complied also with this council's precedent. And here's where I will just touch again on Terrapin Island, and I'll put up, the procedure that was taken in Coral Lakes, as well as the procedure that was done in Terrapin. I'll walk you briefly through it, as I assume, you all have had things come up in the time since it's happened, and I'd like to show you how it is procedurally almost identical. And where it's not, the commission did more in Coral Lakes, favoring affirmation here. So in both, Commissioner Mears made a motion. In both, legal counsel was asked to read the motion into the record. In both, the motion had findings and conditions based on the record below, extensive and detailed. In both, the motion was seconded. In both, there was an opportunity for discussion, which the Hicks don't even mention that in Coral Lakes there was opportunity for discussion prior to the motion being read. In both, there was a vote. In Coral Lakes, there was actually additional reasons given than in Terrapin. And in both, a written decision was provided to the applicants. Based on this record, it cannot be that where the same procedure is undertaken in one appeal and affirmed, that it isn't in the second. That would undermine confidence in the council and appeal.
You've exhausted your time.
Oh, yes. Sorry, I didn't even see that. But for all these reasons, I do want to note that we're opposing a remand here because 9939B2B, council can only remand if there wasn't a logical and orderly review. There was one here. It should be affirmed because the plat complies with applicable code, and any more further delay is prejudicing Shell. Thank you for the additional 58 seconds. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Yeah. Thank you. I will try to, I believe I reserved 5 minutes. I'll try to keep it at on standing. The Planning and Zoning Commission wasn't challenging the Hicks' appellant's standing, and I thought Mr. Horner wasn't really going down that standing route, and then Ms. Mowry mentioned it. So let me be very clear. We cited in the record to the January 27, there are numerous references where these people who did testify articulated specific impact to them, including at pages, Mr. Babushka at page 65, Ms. Hicks at page 68 and 70, Mr. Hicks at page 92, Ms. Russo at 112 and 117, Ms. Petsy Rosenblum at 120 and 125. I'm happy to give specifics, but the notion that these people don't have standing is crazy, disingenuous. As to the notion that the Planning and Zoning Commission only has to state their reasons if they're disapproving an application. That's not what Delaware law says. That's not what your remand order says. That's not the advice of their own counsel. They're relying on 6811 at a minimum, at most, I would say. That simply sets the floor, not the ceiling, on what is required. Substantial, we're ships passing in the night, folks. They keep on relying substantial evidence record. Terrapin, get a look at the whole record. Listen to our argument. We're saying that the reasons these people gave for their votes cannot stand. We didn't argue the record is inadequate. That's not our argument. There's an independent basis for the appeal. Because under Delaware law, a public body must state its reasons, not their counsel's, its reasons for their vote. And I submit that's not what happened here. Terrapin is simply not dispositive of controlling here. I do not believe Terrapin involved these facts at all. Terrapin may have talked about motions and records and substantial evidence. That's fine. Terrapin did not involve the situation where the unambiguous record is that the commissioners voted the way they did because their counsel told them how to vote. Law of the case does not apply. It's an arcane principle. It doesn't apply here. And here, remember, you all remanded for further consideration of all evidence facts of the application. Law of the case, there's no evidence, no support for the notion that that principle should apply to this body. Now, should they be able to rely on advice from counsel? Of course. I'm not saying they shouldn't rely on advice from counsel. I'm not saying that he didn't do a good job explaining what the law is. They're misconstruing our argument on purpose. I'm saying that the council doesn't get a vote, and council can't tell them how to apply the law. A judge doesn't tell a jury how to apply the law. Council doesn't tell its client how to apply the law. That's the Planning and Zoning Commission's job. I have no problem with giving legal advice. I have no problem explaining what the law is. But I guarantee you, the law of Delaware is not, you can't deny it. That's not Delaware law. Do they have to make, am I saying that the Planning and Zoning Commission has got to state every single reason 50 ways to Sunday? No, I didn't make that argument. It's a red herring. But they have to give you some basis for you to be able to decide what their independent basis for approval was. Doesn't exist. How do I know if the council's advice affected the vote? It's right there. Ms. Stevenson, I was told our council says we can't deny it. You can't be any clearer than that. Any other advice would be attorney-client privilege. That's why it's not on the record. I would love to see it, but I respect the attorney-client privilege. Perhaps on remand, you ought to ask what that advice was. That's the reason. Super quick. Again, I said we're not challenging what the law is or what the advice, what the law is. It's rather how it was applied. As to the motion being read and how common that is, again, they're missing our argument. We're saying that the motion was not considered in open session. Not that council made it. As to the rule of law and property rights, I'm not saying that property owners don't have property rights, but it's a balance. Like, everything's a balance, folks. You have to balance the property rights of Shell, and you have to balance the interests of the public and the rule of law as to why a public body needs to state its reasons, not its council reasons, for its decision. Thank you.
We have an opportunity for questions from council later once we get finished.
Very well, thank you.
My objection to the notice requirements is not just, it's strictly not strictly heard to. My objection is it wasn't even substantively followed out. Like I said, I visited site several times for a hearing to review the information. There was never any information listed. So they tell you to go to the website and there's no information there. I had no way to make a basis on my opinion. And they have not supplied when they've put the information there. My experience, it was never there before the hearing. And that's at the that's the one I went to, which was the land use pack, land use listing. Also, as a matter of fact, majority of online packet, hundreds of pages, is still not on file at the Planning and Zoning Office. They did not contest that either. So the official record doesn't even have hundreds of pages of their testimony. The other thing I want to point out was it was DENREC, not me, that said what the wetlands was. DENREC is the one that said the wetlands were being filled. And that's part of the PLUS review, and they are required to respond to that. And so written response to that, and they did not do that. They totally ignored that part. And then lastly, the cases I did for standing, that was their case, and it was on a subdivision. Thank you.
All right. We will.
Is he going to have a comment?
Yes, I believe Mr. Robertson.
I'm sorry,
had some
Mr. Robertson,
time
I apologize.
I don't need any more time, and I thought I used most all of it, so.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll defer it to her 50 seconds.
54 to be exact.
Yes.
No, I don't have anything further to say. Thank you.
Any questions of counsel? Questions of counsel? I don't think so, Judge. I don't hear anybody say anything, so I assume the answer is no.
There being nothing further, Mr. Moore, I believe.
It would be appropriate at this time, then, for the council to retire an executive session, and with a proper motion, Mr. President.
So, any motion to go to executive session?
So moved.
For the purpose of discussing this hearing and the results of it. Motion, Mr. Schaefer. Second.
Second.
Mr. Hudson. Questions? We'll take the vote, Mr. Schaefer.
Yeah.
Mrs. Green?
Yes.
Mr. Hudson?
Yes.
I will, yes. We're not executive session.